Next Sunday is the first time we have done baptisms in a morning service since we've gone to double morning services. So just to make perfectly clear how it works, we've given people who are being baptized the option of being baptized during the first service or the second, and the score is 5-4 for the early service. There are five adults being baptized at 9:15 and another four at 11. If you've got a great appetite for baptism testimonies, I've got a plan for you. Come to the 9:15 service. Hang around for intermission in the gym. For all I know, there might be Easter goodies. And then plan to stick around for the first 10 minutes of the second service, and then you'd see L9. And if you don't have an appetite that warrants two morning services at the same time, or even the portions of two, you could give me a call, and I'll let you know when the person who's being baptized that you're interested in is picking first service or second. That's how we're going to do it, all right? So we look forward to a glorious celebration of the Lord's power to change lives next Sunday morning. It'd be great service to bring people along to. They'll hear nine times individual examples of how the Lord is continuing to save people in these days, and it's going to be a great celebration. We're working our way through the book of Isaiah. We're in the 50s now, in fact, chapter 51. And as you turn there with me and you find the sermon outline in the back of your bulletin, let me tell you a little story that I just made up, but it could have happened, about a baby that was born to Jewish parents in the year 587 BC. And I picked that year specifically because that was the year that Isaiah and the other prophets had been predicting. At least that's the year in which something that he had been predicting would occur. 587 BC was the year in which the Babylonians, that great world-conquering empire that was situated or headquartered in what is now Iraq, would come up against Israel, would surround Jerusalem, would ultimately conquer Jerusalem, would slaughter many thousands of Jewish people, but then deport many thousands more. So let's picture a little baby that was born in the very year of the beginning of the exile. And what we know, because we have all the advantages of hindsight and Bible study, but which many of them were oblivious to, is that that exile, that sitting in slavery for in Babylon, was a period of history that was going to last for seven decades. It was going to be 70 years that God judged would be necessary to get idol worship finally out of the system of Israel once and for all. And it happened. After 70 years of sitting in exile, when Cyrus, the king of Persia, allowed them to go back, they went back to the promised land, and they never really had a problem with worshiping idols again. But it took 70 years for the cure. So let's imagine our little baby, and he's born the year of the exile, and he's deported to Babylon with his parents, and he grows up. And all he ever knows for real life experience is what it's like to be a Jewish slave to the Babylonians. But he hears about how God greatly delivered the people back in the days of Egypt, and he hears about what it was like to live in the land of milk and honey, and he has an interest in that. And so he begins to listen to messages that he hears from God. The prophet Ezekiel, for example, spoke about God's call upon his people and the need they had to repent of their idolatry and to be done with it once and for all and to turn to God. And let's imagine our little baby growing up, and at the age of, say, 40, after four decades of living as a slave, he finally comes to his senses. He repents of the idol worship, which was a part of the mindset and the life of so many of Jewish people, and he turns to God, and he begins to pursue a right relationship with God. And he looks with expectation at what's going to happen next, because he's been a slave and nothing but a slave for 40 years. And now he turns to God, and he looks with great anticipation at what's going to happen next. And what you need to know is that what happened next externally was almost nothing for another 30 years, because the captivity was going to last 70 years. And we're in Isaiah chapter 50 this morning, and 51 this morning, and what we have been seeing over the last few weeks is the idea of trusting God in the absence of immediate solutions. And that's what happened to every Jewish person who listened to prophets like Ezekiel during the exile, came to terms with the sin in his life, and turned to God. What happened was they were challenged to trust God in the absence of any immediate solution, because the captivity was going to last 70 years, whether the people in captivity were to turn to God or not. So for 30 years, all the way through his 40s, and all the way through his 50s, and all the way through his 60s, until his 70th birthday, he continues a slave in Babylon. Now he's trusting God, but he's not seeing any difference on the outside for most of his life. And at 70, he gets to go back to Israel, but he looks on the fact that for 30 years he trusted God without any particular solution, without any quick fix to his problem. That's the That's the phenomenon which we're looking at as we see Isaiah 51 today. And I hope you see the relevance. Some of you are living out the relevance. Perhaps for many years you've wandered from God, and then you've come to terms with what the prophets have been saying, the need to turn to God, to repent of your sin and your waywardness, and to turn to God. You've turned to God. You've become a person who now pursues a right relationship with God. You pursue righteousness. You know righteousness. You're looking for God to begin to solve the problems which in many ways were your own responsibility, problems that you brought upon yourself, and maybe he does. In which case, this won't be very relevant to you, but you want to tuck it away in case it gets relevant. But if he doesn't give you a quick fix to your problem, if you find yourself continuing to be surrounded by the details of the mess you created in the days of your waywardness, well, this message is for you. Here's what God says through his prophet Isaiah to people who are trying to trust him, though they're not getting any immediate payoff in the external details of their lives, people who are seeking to trust God in the absence of immediate solutions. Here's what God has to say. He actually has three things to say, and I'll show you how he says them and what he says as we work our way through chapter 51 and then enter chapter 52. He says in the first place, verses 1 to 3, "Listen to me, you who pursue righteousness, who seek the Lord. Look to the rock from which you were hewn and to the quarry from which you were dug." And all but the poetry majors will say, "Huh?" So he explains in verse 2 what he means about looking to the rock. He means, "Look to Abraham your father and to Sarah who gave birth to you in pain. When he was one, when he was just one person, I called him. Then I blessed him and multiplied him." God is saying to his people, listen to me, you who pursue righteousness, not you who continue to worship idols, but you who have given up idolatry, you who pursue righteousness, listen to me. He says, "I made your whole nation from just one old impotent man." That was Abraham, an old impotent man. He was 100 years old before God's promises to make a great nation out of him began to be true with the birth of his son Isaac. "I made your whole nation," he says, "from just one old impotent man and his barren wife." Sarah was no more able to have children than he was. He was 100 years old and long past the ability to father a child. This would be, under most circumstances, more information than you're interested in, but you need to understand it to get the point. And the other point is that his wife was barren. She always had been barren. She went through all her childbirth years, unable to have a child. And got to 45 when women stopped generally being able to bear children, and that was that. She lived another 45 years. Now she's 90, less able than ever, less likely than ever to have a child. She's 90 years old. She's flipped the odometer twice. She's gone around a second time. She's totally unable to have a child. Yet God had promised to make a great nation out of this man who at one point thought that he could be a father, and this woman who never had been able to have children. And God did it. They had a son named Isaac, who had sons named Jacob and Esau. And Jacob had 12 sons, which is a long, complicated story. And those 12 sons had many sons. And now, though they were sitting in bondage in Babylon, they were a great, great, great nation. And God had done it in the most marvelous way. He had done it from this old couple that didn't look like they could even have one child, let alone be the ancestors of a great nation. And someone will say, "Okay, I get it, but your point?" Well, the point comes in verse 3. And the basis of the fact that looking to the rock from which you were hewn, you see that you came from this very unlikely set of humble circumstances. He says in verse 3, "Indeed, the Lord will comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places, and her wilderness he will make like Eden, and her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness will be found in her, thanksgiving and sound of a melody." So he says, "I made your whole nation from just one old impotent man and his barren wife. I will certainly comfort you." This is an argument from the greater to the lesser. If he could do that, then he certainly could do this. If he could make a great nation out of an old, infertile couple, certainly he could come alongside some struggling believer and comfort him. Couldn't he? And you're supposed to say, "Well, I guess he could." So then God says, that's the first thing I have to say to you who are trusting me in the absence of immediate solutions. You may be lacking an immediate solution to your problem. You may be short a quick fix, but you're not short me. You're not lacking my presence. He says, "I'm there. I'm with you. I will comfort you." So go ahead and continue to live out in these rather disappointing circumstances, in this lack of any solution to your external problems, but know that I'm with you, there to comfort you. I will be your comfort. And some people would say, "Well, fine. That's enough. If God will be with me, then hey, I'm on for it. I'll continue to live without a quick fix. I'll continue to live without solutions to my problems for the rest of my days, just because I know that God is with me. Just because God's comfort is enough. And I know that some of you are living that. Some of you are saying that. That the comfort of God is more than enough to compensate for the lack of answers to prayers that you've been praying earnestly about your details. That's enough for some people. And I suppose it's not enough for others. So God goes on in verses 4 to 8 and says to his people, pay attention to me. Listen to me, you who know righteousness. This is the second thing that God has to say to his people. And it's from verses 4 to 8, but let's race ahead to verse 7 to get to the point. Listen to me, he says in verse 7, you who know righteousness, a people in whose heart is my law. Do not fear the reproach of man, neither be dismayed at their revilings. For the moth will eat them like a garment, and the grub will eat them like wool. But my righteousness shall be forever, and my salvation to all generations. He's speaking specifically to people whose lack of immediate solution had everything to do with the fact that they were living in Babylon against their will. They were living as slaves, and the Babylonians were very cruel and hard slave masters. So they had lots to be afraid of, it seemed, because these Babylonians weren't going anywhere. They were a strong, conquering people, and they'd conquered the whole world. And so it was just the very worst place to be for the Jews. They were slaves to the most powerful nation of the world, and it looked like they always would be. But God says, pay attention to me. He says, the people who reproach you will not last long. They're going to get eaten up like a moth eats a wool sweater. They're just going to get gobbled up. And of course, that's the answer that God gives to us in regard to our problems, whether our problems are people or whether they're impersonal problems. It's Psalm 37 again, Psalm 73. Those two numbers turned around are worth remembering. In Psalm 37 and 73, God says, understand that the wicked are only prospering for a short period of time. Eventually, their prosperity will turn into great, horrendous suffering. So don't you be envying the wicked, and don't you be wondering why they're prospering. It's a short-term thing. Your problems are a short-term thing. But my righteousness and salvation, he says, my righteousness and salvation shall last forever. When someone gives you a gift, as God has given righteousness and salvation to all who call upon his name, the first thing you want to know is whether it's valuable or not, right? Because whether it's valuable or not determines what you're going to do with it and what you think of it and actually what you think of the person who gave it to you. So somebody gives you something, it's wrapped up, and you say, well, thanks, you shouldn't have. And he says, well, it's no big deal. It only cost a couple of quarters. In fact, it's a piece of junk, but I thought I'd pass it on to you. You say, well, thanks anyway. If it's not worth much, it doesn't mean much, right? He can say it's the thought that counts, but if it's only worth a few pennies, it's no big deal. But if somebody gives you a gift and it turns out to be worth a fortune, $1,000 or $100,000 or $100 million, then you've really got something, right? You've got a valuable thing. Well, as soon as you see that what you've been given is valuable, the next question is, how long do I get to keep it? How long will it last? Is there any limitation to this gift? So you want to know, is it valuable? And then you want to know, will it last? Well, God is saying this about the gift he's given us, the gift of righteousness or right relationship to him, the gift of salvation. It's of infinite value, and it will last forever. You know, your enemies will not last forever. They're going to get eaten up by moths, but my righteousness and my salvation will last forever. So there you are, living in your circumstances, and things aren't going tickety-boo the way you really thought they would when you got serious about God, and the problems grind on, and your life grinds on, and you say your prayers, and you ask God, and you believe with all your heart that God is able to solve your problems, and he is able to solve your problems, but he doesn't. And what do you say about that? Well, on the first hand, you say what God tells you to say. God will comfort you. He'll be with you through all of this. You're not alone. His comfort will be your great experience. And then secondly, he's already done for you some wonderful things in giving you the infinitely valuable gift of righteousness and eternal salvation. And that's a gift that will last. That's a gift that will never fade. Your enemies will fade. They seem like they won't, but they will. This gift may or may not seem like it will, but it won't. It'll last forever. And that's what God has to say to us who perhaps live in the absence of immediate solutions. He will be there to comfort us, and what he's already given us is a great gift that will last forever. Well, we get an interruption in our text this morning. We're looking at the three things that Isaiah communicates from God, the three things that God says to people in this particular predicament. But at this point, Isaiah kind of takes over, stops prophesying, and starts praying. So in verses 9 to 11, we see what Isaiah prays to God. And this is the first wake-up call of two wake-up calls that we see in our text this morning. Isaiah prays in verses 9 to 11, and here he shows us how to pray. He shows us some things about biblical prayer, which are very, very worth learning so that we pray properly. He says, "Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in the days of old, the generations of long ago. Was it not thou who cut Rahab in pieces?" That's not Rahab the prostitute in the book of Joshua. That's Rahab the chaos monster. It's a poetic reference to Egypt. "Was it not thou who cut Egypt in pieces, who pierced the dragon? Was it not thou who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a pathway for the redeemed to cross over?" He's praying here, and interestingly prays, "Wake up, God." He says, "Get on with it, God." And it's interesting that God allows him to record that. That God is not displeased with a prayer which is a call upon God to get on with it. But you see, the prayer is grounded upon his knowledge of God, upon the character of God. He thinks about what God has done in the past, in the days when he rescued his people from Egypt. And he says, "Wasn't that you back there, God?" And drawing on what God did, he takes great strength from what God is, a God of deliverances, a God of forgiveness, a God of redeeming and restoration. He says, "Wasn't that you?" So his prayer is grounded upon God's character as revealed in God's actions. And then verse 11, it's directed by the promises that God has made. For in verse 11, which gives us the lyrics to one of the choruses we sang this morning, he actually quotes himself. He quotes from chapter 35 when he gave a prophecy of what God said he would do one day. "So the ransomed of the Lord will return," he says, "and they will come with joyful shouting to Zion, and everlasting joy will be on their heads. They will obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing will flee away." So he says, all right, this is what God is. That was God back there who delivered his people in the olden days. So he's a God who delivers, and he's promised that he will deliver us. He promised through Isaiah back in chapter 35. So he takes the promises of God. Standing on the character of God, he takes the promises of God, and he calls upon God on the basis of his character, on the basis of his promises, to get on with it. And he speaks in a way that we might be inclined to say is kind of irreverent, but God endorses it. God says, you can say this to God. You can say, "Oh God," you want to say it reverently, but you can say it. "Oh God, wake up. Oh God, get going. Fulfill your promises." And Isaiah himself interjected this prayer to show us that while we are, you know, waiting upon God for the long-term solutions to our problems, we should be praying based on his promises that he will do what he promised to do. And that's what prayer should be. But then God gets back to it in verse 12. And verses 12 to 16 shows us the third thing that God has to say to people who are living without quick solutions to their big problems. Here's what he says, verse 12 and 13 to start. "I, even I, am he who comforts you." See, it's a review. Isaiah interrupted, so God reviews. "I am the one who comforts you. Who are you that you're afraid of man who dies and the son of man who's made like grass?" So this is a continuation of a second point about how your enemies will fade quickly. Who are you that are afraid of man who dies and of the son of man who's made like grass? "That you've forgotten the Lord your maker, who stretched out the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth, that you fear continually all day long because of the fury of the oppressor as he makes ready to destroy." But where is the fury of the oppressor? God says, "I, even I, am he who comforts you." And then, when the one who comforts you is God, when the one who comforts you is God, you don't need to be afraid of anybody. So in the second place, he said, I've given you something that will last forever. Your enemies won't last forever. Here in the third place, he says, and you don't need to be afraid of your enemies. There's no enemy, whether it's a human enemy or whether it's an intangible or an impersonal enemy, that you need to fear. You don't need to be afraid of anybody, because I'm the God who's created the heavens and the earth. I'm the God who's working all things out for my purposes and for the good of my people. So you don't need to be afraid of anybody. Paul the Apostle picks up on this in Romans 8. He says, if God is for us, well, who can be against us? And of course, the answer is lots of people can be against us. And the more we are for God, the more people will be against us. But it adds up to a big so what. It doesn't matter who can be against us, because they can't really do any harm to us, because God is with us, and he'll comfort us, and so we need not fear anybody. And it's pretty terrific to know that there were people who were going to be living in these circumstances, in exile for 70 years, who picked up on this truth from Isaiah, perhaps, and from the rest of the scriptures, and lived fearlessly in the face of their captors. Think about those three men whose names were changed to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, written about in the book of Daniel, chapter 3. That wasn't their names, not the names their mothers gave them, but it's the names that their captors gave them, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And Nebuchadnezzar made a great statue, and upon threat of death, commanded everyone to bow down and worship the statue. And all kinds of captives did. You can't fight City Hall. They bowed down and they worshiped the statue. Well, they were down there in Babylon just because they had come from a long line of idol-worshiping, faithless followers of God. And so they just did what they'd always thought to do. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused. And they had this kind of fearlessness that comes from realizing that when the one who comforts you is God, you don't need to be afraid of anybody. So they have this threat. They'll be thrown into a furnace of blazing fire unless they bow down and worship this statue. And, you know, they could have said, well, it's just a statue, and, you know, it's God's will that I'm here. I mean, God can't expect me to do something so inappropriate and politically incorrect as to not bow down when everybody else is bowing down. I mean, that must have been what was going on in the minds of some of their friends. Yeah, let's just bow down. It's no big deal. No, it's just a piece of gold. And it's just acknowledging metalworks. I mean, they could have rationalized it, but Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego played on a higher playing field. So we have the wonderful, fearless thing they said in Daniel chapter 3. The king threatens them, and they say, maybe one of them says, maybe Shadrach starts and says, if it be so, you know, if you're going to do this to us, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. That's what one of them said, I think. And then the next guy, Meshach, says, and he will deliver us out of your hand. Now, this is no big deal. This is not talking frankly to your best friend. This is some Holocaust survivor Jew talking to Hitler. This is some guy suffering under the thumb of some tyrant, looking the tyrant in the face and saying, and he will deliver us out of your hand. And then third man in says, and even if he doesn't, we're not going to bow down to your God. We're not going to worship your graven image. So we think God will deliver us, but if he doesn't, well, too bad. We're not going to bow down. So you see how they learned the lesson. We're looking for an immediate solution here. But if God doesn't immediately solve our problem, We're going to stay strong here. We're going to be faithful. That's the lesson that God meant to be teaching his people. It would take 70 years before the nation learned it to any great extent. But even midstream, people like Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel, their friend, learned to say it. And there it is, you see. You look for a speedy solution to your problems, and God may be delighted to poof, free you of your problems. But if he doesn't, what are you going to do? How long will you give God to deliver you? If he has some perfectly good reasons beyond our understanding for keeping us in our problems for a long time, what are you going to do? Well, what you're supposed to do is fearlessly look at your enemies and say, but I'm not going to serve your God. I'm going to serve the God I serve. I'm going to continue to persevere. So that's what God says to us when we're faced with the dilemma of having to trust him, though it doesn't seem to be paying off that we are trusting him. He says, I will comfort you. I'll be with you every step of the way. I've given you some great things that will last forever, particularly your rightness with me and your salvation. And I will look after your enemies, so you don't need to worry or even fear them at all. And that's what God has to say to the people. And having said that, Isaiah, with still some papyrus to write on and some ink in his pen, writes on. He comes up with a four-point application for all of us who get the point. All of us who need to get the point. So as we read on from verses 17 to chapter 52, verse 12, we get a short four-point guide to making good use of these truths. And the first comes from verse 17 of chapter 51. Rouse yourself, Isaiah says. Rouse yourself. Arise, O Jerusalem. He'll say it again in chapter 52, verse 1. Awake, awake. Basically, he says, wake up. He says, rouse yourself. He's a prophet, so he talks like that. Rouse yourself. But you know what he means is what we mean when we say to people who don't seem to be clicking in that it's time to click in. We say, well, wake up and smell the coffee, Charlie. Or we say, come on, give your head a shake. Or we say, hello. We say, come on, get with it. And this is what God says to us through Isaiah. This is what Isaiah says. Okay, God has promised to comfort us. God has given us a lasting treasure that you'll never lose, an infinitely valuable treasure that you'll never lose. He will destroy your enemies so you don't need to be afraid of them. So come on, let's get on with it. This is what he says, right? Wake up, okay? Wake up already, he says. And that's the first thing. And so what are we going to do now that we're awake? Well, verse 1 of chapter 52 gives us the next thing to do. He says, awake, awake, clothe yourself in your strength, O Zion. Clothe yourself in your strength. In other words, he says, be strong. He doesn't say go find some strength. He says clothe yourself in your strength. Like the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 16 doesn't say get strong. He says, 1 Corinthians 16, 13, be strong. He says, be on the alert, stand firm in the faith, act like men, be strong. And I hope you can see a difference between get strong and be strong, because it's the second, it's be strong that he says. Get strong means right now you're too weak for your challenges, so you better go do something about that fast. Go find yourself some strength. But be strong is to say you are already able to take on your challenges. So go ahead and take them on. You see, it's like someone comes to you who's been working in the pharmaceutical business for years, and you've never found him to fail. He's always been true to his word. He says, got a little tablet here. This tablet, just take one. You know, one for a lifetime is enough. This tablet will give you enough strength to lift 5,000 pounds over your head whenever you need to. And you know he's telling the truth, so you take the tablet. I don't recommend this, but if somebody says that to you, you should be doubtful. But in the story, he's not a person you doubt. So you take the tablet. Now, evidently, you're able to lift 5,000 pounds over your head whenever you need to. Well, what are you going to do about that? Depends on your circumstances, right? But if you need to lift 5,000 pounds over your head, you know, you're going down the road and you get involved in an interaction with some moving vehicles and suddenly find a minivan on top of you or something, you would say, well, I've got the strength for the challenge. I guess I'll use the strength. Up and at him, and you take the minivan, you lift it over your head because he gave you the strength to do that, right? So be strong is a whole lot different than get strong. You've got the strength, now use it. The point is, you're going to need to be a strong person to continue trusting God in the lack of immediate solutions to your problems. You're going to need to be a strong person. Well, hello, he says, good news, wake up, you are a strong person. You have the Lord to comfort you. So the strength is there, so go ahead and be strong. And you say, okay, but like what? Like what are some of the things that require strength? And he says, thanks for asking. I'll give you point 3 and point 4 as illustrations of what you need to be strong about. So then we get to chapter 52, verse 7. And he says, how lovely on the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who announces peace and brings good news of happiness, who announces salvation and says to Zion, your God reigns. This is where we get that song from. It's a bit of poetry. It would only appeal to, or even perhaps be understandable to, poetic people. Someone has come a long distance to tell you the good news that the God you worship actually is in charge of and complete control of the whole universe. So you're worshiping the God of Israel. Somebody comes to you and says, did you know that the God that you worship, the God that has brought you into relationship with him, is actually a God of infinite power, and he uses his power, and he's ruling over the whole world? And you say, good news, good news. My, you've got lovely feet. And that's a figure of speech. That means, how good of you to come all this way on your own feet. It doesn't really work in the year 2001, but I hope you get the point. The point is that it's a very, very good thing to tell people this good news, even if you have to walk somewhere to tell them, even if you have to exert some effort to tell them. And it might not be walking effort. It might be risking embarrassment effort. It might be ruining the party effort. You see an opportunity to speak up for the Lord. There's where you need the strength. So point 3 is tell the good news. And that's something you need to be strong to do. You see, you're in this circumstance. You've had your problems, and then you turn to the Lord. And You keep that to yourself because it's a personal matter. And you're looking to the Lord to solve your problems, and he doesn't solve your problems, but he gives you a wonderful ability to be resilient through your problems. And people notice that about you. They see you struggling with your difficulty, whether it's a health problem or a relational problem or an economic problem, and they see that you're doing really, really great. Now, if you continue to play shy about your faith, what are they going to conclude? They're going to conclude, my, he's an outstanding man of character. What a tough guy. Life has served him lemons and he's made lemonade. What a resilient kind of guy he is. Great, great, great guy. You see, and that's not the message you're supposed to be communicating with your life. Because it's not about you being a great guy. It's about God being a great God and shoring you up and holding you up and sustain you through the problems. And think about this. God wouldn't have the chance to advertise through you if he had solved your problem immediately. Maybe that's a hint to why there's sometimes no immediate solutions. But it's so important while you're finding his comfort in your ongoing difficulties to speak up about it. So somebody says, well, you seem to be holding up all right, old brick. And you say, well, you know what? I mean, they have to say something. You have to be strong enough to say something. You say, a while ago, I had a spiritual experience, a religious experience, and I personally committed myself to Jesus Christ, and I've come into a right relationship with God through Jesus Christ, and I find day by day that God gives me the strength to get through these difficulties. So you know, what you're seeing here is not some man of steel doing his thing. What you see is a weak person who God is strengthening. So that's what you do. That's what you say. And then God gets the glory, as he should, for the strength with which he is allowing you to persevere through your difficulties. See? So that's why he's putting you through the difficulties, at least why in part, and that's what you're supposed to do about it. You're supposed to tell the good news, and you say, well, I could never do that. Well, take this tablet, then you can lift 5,000 pounds over your head. Just trust God. He will give you, he has given you the strength. Be strong, strong to tell the good news. And that's not the only thing you need to tell, to be strong for, point four. It comes from verse 11. He says, depart, depart. Go out from there. Touch nothing unclean. Go out of the midst of her. Purify yourselves, you who carry the vessels of the Lord. The fourth thing you have to do, which is actually the second thing that requires strength, point four, is be holy. Be holy. Be without sin. That is, resist temptation. And there again, you're not told to go out and find the strength to resist temptation. You're told to use the strength that God has given you to resist temptation. And it's said in a variety of ways in the Bible. Here's how Paul says it to the Corinthians, 2 Corinthians 7, verse 1. Therefore, having these promises, beloved, let's cleanse ourselves from all defilement of flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. Let's cleanse ourselves from what defiles. Let's complete the holiness that God has given us. He's given us the position of righteousness. Let's grow in actual righteousness by resisting temptation and continuing to resist it and saying yes to God and no to sin, and so be holy people. And I hope you can see how important it is that we be holy people, because God is going to draw attention to himself through us. And if we're moral reprobates while he continues to sustain us, it communicates the terrible message that you can look to God for help in your circumstances and it won't make any difference to your weekend plans. It won't make any difference to your appetites for the wickedness that surrounds you. See, so we need to be holy in order to be good demonstrations of the righteousness and the salvation of God. So I was wondering this week how to illustrate this point, and then I went into my email, and you get a lot of stuff over the internet if you want to, and I get the sermons of John Piper, who's preaching through Romans chapter 7. And this was just so appropriate, so brilliant. Got to pass on to you a sermon illustration from an unrelated sermon from a present-day hero of mine on the power of temptation and the power to resist the temptation which God calls us to have. And this is a very clear, graphic, poetic illustration. On one particular point, if this temptation is of any temptation to you, it'll be very relevant. If it's not, well, then you need to compare it to the sort of things you're tempted to displease God with. John Piper says, how can you really know the power of temptation? How can you really know the power of, say, the temptation to lust, say, to look at pornography on the internet? How can you really know that power if you've never given in and experienced it? He says, let me give an answer in a parable. There are three men. And each of the three stands beside a pit of lewdness and sin. Three ropes extend out of the pit, one bound around each man's waist. The strength of the narrow cord in each case is 100-pound test. It will hold 100 pounds of force. So, in actual fact, what we got are three men staying up late at night, staring into their computer screen. Their fingers are on the mouse button, and they're thinking of clicking onto a pornographic site to indulge in the lust of the flesh, to lust after the photographs that are easily accessible there. But the picture he wants us to compare is three men standing on the edge of a pit, and they've got these cables around their waist. The first man begins to be pulled into the pit. That looks exciting, but he knows it's deadly. 5 pounds of pressure, 10 pounds, 15 pounds. He resists and fights back. 20 pounds, 25. He digs in his heels with all his might. 30 pounds, 35 pounds. And the rope starts to squeeze, and he stops resisting and jumps in. That is, click goes the mouse button. The second man begins to be pulled into the pit. 5 pounds of pressure, 10 pounds, 15 pounds. He resists and fights back. 20 pounds, 25 pounds. He digs in his heels. 30 pounds, 35 pounds, and the rope starts to squeeze. He says, no, and he fights back. 40 pounds, 45 pounds, 50 pounds, 55 pounds. It's hard to breathe as the rope tightens around his stomach. It begins to hurt. 60 pounds. He stops resisting. He jumps into the pit. Click. The third man begins to be pulled into the pit. 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 pounds of pressure. He resists and fights back. 30, 35, 40, and the rope starts to squeeze. He says, no, and he fights back. 70 pounds, and his feet start to slip toward the pit. He cries out for help and reaches out to grab something. He grabs a branch. It's shaped like a cross. In the distance, he sees his wife going about her business, trusting him to be a man of integrity. He sees his children playing, and they're happy children. In their hearts, they admire him. They admire his character. And beyond them all, he sees Jesus Christ with a gash in his side, standing with both hands lifted and fists clenched and smiling and filled with passion for Christ, passion for holiness, a passion for the integrity of his life and for his family. The third man holds fast, 75 pounds, 80, 85 pounds. The rope is cutting into his side. The pain is stabbing. 90, 95 pounds. The tears flow unbidden down his cheeks. 100 pounds of force, and the rope snaps. No click. Now the question is, which of these men knows the full power of temptation? I could say, which of these men learns that we are strong enough through Christ who strengthens us to resist temptation? Only the third man learned that. Piper says, I look around this room and I say, are there any soldiers here? Does anyone in this room have blood on his shirt and scars on his side? Do you know the power of temptation? And do you know how strong the Lord is able to make you to resist temptation? Or do you just jump in before its power is spent? There are battles to be fought. For some, it's that battle right there. Whether it's a battle that they fight on their computers, or a battle with magazines or television or movie theaters. The battle against pornography is real and painful. But God is strong. And other people who are somehow free of that particular temptation are tempted in other ways, with other lusts of the flesh or other lusts of the world or other ploys of the devil. And it's important, because God means to be using us and our circumstances to display his greatness. It's important for us to resist temptation and to be strong in the Lord, so that as people see that we are and we communicate to them why we are, they will learn to turn to the Lord as well. So Isaiah says, now wake up, be strong, tell people why you're strong, and be holy, resist temptation. Come to the Lord, receive his forgiveness, receive it again if you need to receive it again, and then be strong. And you will be a demonstration by the very life you live that our God is a great, great God.